this is the second bunch of episodes that I'm releasing in one day. I think there's going to be 8 of them again. Now, with that last batch, I had to take a quick break because I was on tour. I didn't have the time to watch all those movies that I needed to make a proper episode. And as the regular listeners will already know, those episodes tend to be split into 2 parts and they roll on for around 5 hours. So many hours upon hours upon hours of watching and writing and compiling and recording. And I just don't think I'm going to have the time to do it justice. So if you woke up this morning and you're expecting to hear the first part of the 1920s to 1930s episode, many apologies. That will be coming out on the 1st of November. And I very much doubt that this will be happening again, not until mid-2022 anyway. That is the next time I'm planning on having a holiday. I just really don't want to bring you lot a half-assed stab at an episode. I'm just not willing to do it. So instead, as in August, I've taken a bunch of my favourite chats that I've already included in those long-winded episodes and I've pulled them out for anyone to listen to individually. There will no doubt still be some content in the month, but the regular programming will continue on November the 1st. And with that, here you go.
Excellent.
In 2010, Darren Aronofsky, he followed up his financially successful and critically acclaimed sporting character study movie, The Wrestler, with an altogether more terrifying prospect. Come 2010, Aronofsky delivered onto us his even more financially successful and more critically acclaimed and Oscar-winning tale named Black Swan.
I had the craziest dream last night about a girl who was turned into a swan, but her prince falls for the wrong girl and she kills herself. He promised to feature me more this season.
Well, he should. You've been there long enough. And you're the most dedicated dancer in the company.
Our new swan queen, the exquisite Nina Sayers.
Lily, you're gonna be amazing.
Watch the way she moves. Sensual. She's not faking it.
Seduces! Attack it! Attack it! Come on!
Where'd you get these?
It's nothing.
You sweet girl.
Feel my touch. Respond to it.
Because someone's hot for teacher. I don't want to talk about that.
You really need to relax.
It's the role, isn't it? It's all this pressure. I knew it'd be too much. I knew it.
What's she doing here? He made me your alternate.
The only person standing in your way is you.
And there is no tagline here from Letterboxd. I'm gutted. The synopsis is as follows. A journey through the psyche of a young ballerina whose starring role as the duplicitous Swan Queen turns out to be a part for which she becomes frighteningly perfect. Now, last episode was 2001, and I made it very clear that I was not a fan of musicals, and yet that Buffy musical, Once More With Feeling, that was my number 2 pick of the year. Well, I can't think really of what I dislike more than musicals. Maybe ballet? Yeah, definitely ballet. So, of course, the only psychological horror ballet film that came out in 2010, yes, the only one, that is my number 2 yet again. In an interview surrounding this movie, Aronofsky, he compared the story of Swan Lake to that of the story of the werewolf, half-human, half-wolf, and half-human, half-swan. And I can see that. I mean, the horror element here is evident from the off. Whether it's the similarities between the relationship, say, between Carrie and her overbearing religious mother in that movie called Carrie, to me, that clearly mirrors the overbearing mother played here by Barbara Hershey. Or that transformation body horror work, which is horrifically beautiful, brings to mind Cronenberg at his very best. Horror is always present throughout this film. And talking of Barbara Hershey, I mean, she did the job that she needed to do in the Insidious movies. I get that. But I think this is her best role since The Entity. And that was way back in 1982. And she doesn't have a huge amount of screen time to work with here. But I can tell you, once you watch it, if you haven't done already, you won't forget her performance. She takes that overbearing trope that I first become aware with myself in Carrie, and she sort of smooths out the edges, makes it far more believable, far more terrifying because you can believe it. There is no cartoon aspect to her performance here. But still, I cannot give her the MVP, the Most Valuable Player award here, because that has to go to Natalie Portman. She did win the Academy Award for her performance after all. And the first thing I want to say about that is 100% yes, this performance is worth that award. It is an exceptional performance for anybody in her profession. Her depiction of Nina here is just so all-encompassing. It's outstanding from the first beat to the last. Yeah, I mean, what can I say? She's utterly convincing in this role. I never feel like she's over-egging the character. And I think that when you look at this film and this script on paper, it really does give the impression that this performance is going to have to be over-egged and overblown. But no, she does not treat it that way. She doesn't treat it that way at all. She plays it straight when she has to. She plays it large when she has to. But I never don't believe her. And I think that's really, with any film of this genre, that's what you're looking for. You never want to be taken out of the film. You never want to think, oh, that was done for Oscar bait. You never want to think, oh, that person's trying way too hard. I can see through that. In a leading role, I think you just want to be fully absorbed into that character and where that character fits within the film. And that's not to say that she doesn't have this incredible dynamic role written for her. And at points, I feel like, until the very final scenes, that this movie is like one of those Rocky training montage sessions broken down into this off-kilter 90-minute gutbuster of a film. The commitment and the mental and physical pain and the stress on screen is there at all times, and it's never spelled out to its audience. It's just repetition, repetition, repetition. And no matter how many times she goes through this tough routine, she just can't seem to deliver that perfection that she has to reach. Like, this movie is a must-see. If you haven't got around to it yet, stop putting it off and let this epic film reveal itself to you, just like it did to me. Now, I was really happy to chat about this one with Serena Cherry. She is a guitarist and a singer with the band Svalbard, who in 2020, they gained a ton of critical success in the metal underground scene with their album When I Die, Will I Get Better? Now, a few years ago, I had the pleasure, a rather fortunate position to be in, to choose exactly what bands we wanted to go on tour with in my band. And I loved Svalbard at the time. I loved their crusty metal sound. And I asked them if they'd like to come along and join us for a weekend of shows that started at the bottom of the country and ended up right in Glasgow at the top. It was a wonderful period of my life, and I'll never forget it. I got to watch Serena and her band every night, and then after that, I would go and scream my lungs out after they'd finished. Now, as luck would have it, Serena also has a rather unique insight to this movie, so please welcome to A Year in Horror, Serena Cherry.
It's really exciting for me to talk about something that's not music. You know what I mean? Like, I'm excited.
Well, I'm afraid to say the first question is going to be a little bit musicky when we get to it. But first of all, when did you first come across Black Swan?
I saw it at the cinema when it came out in 2010. I'm one of those people, I'm totally indiscriminate when it comes to movies, and I'll go and see anything. I just like going to the cinema. But to be fair, I am a big fan of Natalie Portman. And I think the advertising campaign for that film was great, with the kind of stark contrast, black and white sort of imagery and things. The goth in me was hooked just from seeing the poster.
100%. The darkness of it, I can definitely see where that goth thing's coming from. It was something that, amongst everything else in 2010, stood out completely. Thinking of the ballet aspect of it, did that put you off at all? Was that something that intrigued you?
No, well, fun fact about me, I trained as a dancer from the age of 4 years old. If anything, it actually really, really spoke to me, like the kind of the grueling aspect of ballet. I mean, to be fair, I only did ballet for a few years and then I progressed on to modern dancing. That was my forte. But yeah, I think that drew me in even more, like the black tutu. I was like, this is perfect. It's gothy and it's dance.
That is amazing. What, how, wow. I'm speechless at that. So like, okay, there is, like from the off in this film, there is moments that when I think of the effort that I put into music and everything that I do, that just completely puts me to shame. Like the training and the sincerity and the toughness of that job just to get yourself like into a fighting state for it. It seems incredible and very grueling. Is that something that you had to put up with it when you were training?
I trained up until the age of 18 years old and sort of would compete for medals and all sorts of things. And yeah, it was like very, very physical. You know, you sort of, you're constantly, you know, if you sort of go to the gym and you ache a bit the next day, it's like that all the time. Your body basically never really recovers and there's always another physical level to reach. Do you know what I mean? There's always another like, oh, I need to be more flexible in that area, or I need to get this jump higher. Like it's sort of never ending physical challenge dance.
Yeah, Nina in the film, like she's got this passion for it and the repetitive nature of what she's doing, it brings that perfection, but it comes at the cost of passion. And that's the thing that really got me. And it that happens with the musician in their life. And that's where I'm going to with this musician thing. Like, is it something in music that it happens to you as well? Like, is there a point where you think, I don't need to master this to make it sound really good? There's this something else, this special something that you haven't reached yet, or is it more natural?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think, yeah, I'm probably the opposite. But when it comes to music, I'm not technical at all. I'm a self-taught guitarist. I don't know, you know, scales or chords or any of that stuff. And for me, I liken it to, it's like being possessed by something else. And I would rather hear, you know, Stephen Wilson play one note with feeling than some djent band play 60 million notes really fast. You know, I think there's that difference between treating something. And this goes, interestingly, for dance as well. The difference between treating something as a sport and treating it as an art.
When I watched this, it did draw those parallels. But as I say, there was much more training in this. I thought going full cards on the table, I was put off watching this film because of the ballet angle. I thought it would be something that would not interest me in any way. And I remember the campaign for it. I remember people saying, oh, Paul, no, it's a horror. You'll really enjoy this. So it's like, this isn't going to interest me. I felt so stupid that I missed it on the big screen and I waited until it came out, because it doesn't have to be about ballet, this. It could be about most anything that you are sort of addicted to and want to get better at and perfect. I'm easily put off by something that I don't like. With you, when you've got something that you instantly know you're going to like it, I guess it was a lot easier for you to go like, I'm bang into this. Like from the first scenes, were you like, oh, this is a bit of me?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this film really, really appealed to me from the get-go. It was one of those films where I was excited, you know, yeah, just from seeing the poster and reading about the concept of it. And I think what intrigued me the most was the way the director was sort of tying the sort of grueling demands of physical demands of ballet with the kind of mental health aspects that run throughout the film as well. Mm-hmm. And I sort of read a little bit about that before seeing the film, and I think that was what really sort of drew me in, was the symbolism that, you know, I thought was going to be there. But also, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, when you think ballet and horror, it's not two things that people would put together. So I can understand people sort of not diving in straight away, because it seems a bit of a jarring combination.
Well, it definitely works. If you were just watching it without that frame of reference, the film still works. But when you've got that frame of reference and the overbearing mother aspects of thing, and you know, you can see how this is actually grinding someone down where they haven't had that ability to let off steam in other ways. Like, all of a sudden, this film takes on a much grander scale than what you're just seeing. And what you're seeing is already ridiculously grand. It's rare in a film. I've just come back to this again and again. Whereas with my normal daily horror watch, it's something that you can just pick apart in 2 minutes. This is like a real big deal and something that I find, and I don't know if you've done this, like on a rewatch, I'm constantly finding other bits that I can grab onto.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I rewatched it a couple of days ago before this podcast, just to sort of have a refresh. And yeah, I noticed whole new layers and meanings that I didn't the last time I watched it, which was really interesting. Like for me, a big one was kind of, I mean, the film is quite like, you know, there's like a sort of, what's the right word to it? There's like a sexuality to the main character and she's very sort of repressed. And I think there is this kind of thread about her finding her sexuality throughout the film. But then as I was looking at it more and more when I was last watching it, I was like, oh, the blood represents her becoming a woman and like fertility and, you know, breaking free from the overbearing mother and not being a child. And I was like, I think there's so many layers to this film. And then sort of the way, I think initially when I saw it at the cinema, the one bit I didn't like was when sort of her legs bend backwards as if she is becoming a swan. Sorry. And I remember thinking, oh, it's gone a bit too far now into preposterousness. But now I sit there and watch it and go, whoa, it's amazing, because it's obviously to symbolize that the role has fully consumed her. And, you know, she has just been utterly like, so devoted to this art that it's destroying her.
I find it fascinating. Like those fantasy elements were at first, when I first watched it, sort of ruining what I thought was like a great film. And normally I'm the opposite to that. On my second and third watch, I couldn't wait for those bits to come because I was like, oh, I'm sort of understanding this. I don't know and still don't know. And I was wondering if you had a thought upon it. Spoilers are allowed here. Does she die at the end? What do you think?
I think she does.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, that was my take on it. I mean, oh, I don't know. She either dies or she transforms into, you know, the perfect art. Oh, but then I think the message is that she has died to reach that unattainable perfection. Oh, it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Well, that's it. So me and my partner, we have a little row about this. So I think she's dead. I think she's successfully achieved her goal and she's given all she can give in this. And I think she found her adulthood too late. And it took everything out of her to achieve it. But she got there and she's died. Claire, my partner, she's of the thing, well, no, this, I think this just represents blossoming into womanhood. Like she's achieved that, and she's not actually died. So it's a trick. Now, because she's thinking that, and she's always right about these things, and I'm always wrong. I just think, oh, all right, okay, maybe that is the case. So I watched it again with this in mind, still none the wiser at all.
I suppose it could be symbolic of, you know, the little girl is dead and the woman is alive. Or yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? But I always think that's a mark of a good film, if everyone can come away from it and have their own different takes and their own different interpretations and meanings of a scene or an ending. Like, that's good, because art should generate discussion.
Oh, 100%. I mean, do you think Aronofsky, do you think he's portrayed women fairly in this?
I think it's a really interesting portrayal, because there's like a lot of sort of stereotypes at play. And yeah, there's kind of like the sort of overbearing mother and things, and the sort of, oh, the main character is frigid and therefore she has no passion, and Lily, Mila Kunis's character, is, you know, very kind of like not frigid, and then she's like kind of the seen as the better dancer for it. And it's, yeah, there's a lot of sort of stereotypes and assumptions at play. But then I also think he's captured a lot of things like really well. Like, I know this doesn't sound weird to talk about, but the dream, Nina, who's played by Natalie Portman, has like a sexy dream about Mila Kunis. And that scene is really nice to watch as a woman, because it's not actually that gratuitous. Like, it's very much kind of like, you don't feel that sort of scene has been played to the male gaze, where it could have gone, you know, very much that way. So there are definitely aspects where I feel like it's, you know, he portrays women well, and I think I can get the point that he's trying to make about the difficulties of that transitions from being a girl to being a woman. But then I do think there are, you know, some very obvious Hollywood stereotypes thrown in. Interestingly, though, on the subject of how Darren Aronofsky portrays people, I found out he received a load of criticism for how he portrayed ballet. And ballet dancers were really sort of cheesed off with him, sort of saying, oh, you know, he made it sort of look like you could just, the directors of companies pick the women they fancy for the roles, and, you know, that it doesn't take that much work to achieve these things. And yeah, it was really interesting to read that professional ballet dancers apparently sort of have a bit of a backlash towards the film.
When you pick any, like, ballet or some other sport, for instance, or anything like that, there's always going to be criticisms of those involved in that you haven't achieved your goals. There's always that dichotomy sort of thing of, are you going to make a great film here, or are you going to make a realistic film? It's a real trick to get right. I always judge it on my cringe factor. If there's something on screen that is making me cringe, doesn't make me feel at all comfortable, even if I can't put my finger on it, I'm very aware of it. And I was never aware of such things in this film. And with a lot of what I watch, there is just that moment of cringe where it's, oh, why did you do that? So yeah, I think he's done a good job here, but what do I know? You know, what do I know? I don't know anything about ballet. That's the thing. What I know about ballet is what I've seen in this movie. Speaking of Aronofsky, just a couple more questions. And again, thank you so much for your time here. My favorite of his is The Fountain. I absolutely love The Fountain. And I also have a real soft spot for Mother. Is there any film that he's made that you are particularly passionate about, or is this the one for you?
Do you know what? My favorite Darren Aronofsky, God, it's hard to say, isn't it? is The Wrestler.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Interesting choice. But like, and also I found out that Black Swan was done as a companion piece to The Wrestler. So they're both sort of meant to be these films about, you know, demanding roles in life and that performative aspect and being obsessed with representing yourself to the perfection of the art that you're in and stuff like that. And then when I found that out, I went, oh yeah, that makes loads of sense. But yeah, The Wrestler for me, I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan, so the soundtrack definitely does it for me. And just that kind of the bleakness of it, but it is so powerful. And the ending, like, yeah, The Wrestler, I think, has the most heart for me out of the Darren Aronofsky films that I've seen. I've not actually seen Mother yet, though, so
I truly recommend it. I remember watching The Wrestler and crying like I was a child. touched me. Serena, thank you so much for coming on. I've got one final question for the listeners out there that maybe haven't seen Black Swan yet. I think I know what the answer is going to be, but would you recommend it?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously it's a psychological horror, so don't expect jump scares, don't expect, you know, the kind of stuff that you usually get in your average horror movie. It's the kind of film that really gets under your skin and makes you think. And that's why I love it. So I would definitely recommend it to the listeners.
Serena, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, I do think it is really important to discuss the music within movies when it's relevant, and it is really relevant here. And because Clint Mansell used so many elements in his score of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake.
That is Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky.
No matter how drastically altered they were, it didn't matter to the Academy. Black Swan was not allowed by the Academy to be entered into the awards for consideration. And I think if it were, and it should have been, it would have destroyed the competition. And the nominees for 2011, of course, they were judging majority of films from 2010. They were 127 Hours, How to Train Your Dragon, which is actually quite the fantastic score, Inception and The King's Speech. But the movie that won was The Social Network, and that one was by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, which, listening back today, is pretty good, and it works well with the film, but it's nowhere near all-encompassing as this is. As you heard, Clint's score is nothing short of beautiful. It's equal parts minimal and epic, grand yet subtle, terrifying yet life-affirming. It may be the best score that I've talked about so far on A Year in Horror. And as soon as you've done with this, head over to Spotify and press play, and I promise you, you'll get as swept up in it as I do. Right, that's about it. Where can you watch this one? That's the heading of the next little part of this, so I'm going to tell you exactly where. You can stream it right now, if you live in the UK, on Now TV or Sky Go. Everywhere else, you're going to have to rent it on VOD, or you can do this. You can buy the Blu-ray, it's always dirt cheap. Or if you're a proper tight arse just like me, then just go to Poundland and buy it on DVD for a quid. They are always full of Black Swan. There is loads of them there. No matter what branch you go to, you'll find it. And finally, to the podcasts, where you can listen in far more detail than I or Serena go into here. You can find out all the ins and outs of how Aronofsky delivered this epic piece of filmmaking. And I think really, if you can find these two, this is exactly all you'll need as an accompaniment. So first of all, of course I'm going to mention it. Evolution of Horror. They batched Black Swan on the 19th of November 2020 with another Aronofsky early work, Requiem for a Dream. And also there's a great episode of Faculty of Horror. That's from 2014, so way, way back. The very dawn of podcasting. And they batched it with Drag Me to Hell, of all films, yeah. But they are both great, great listens. So there you have it, Black Swan.
Excellent day for an exhibition.
You know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Ever you do.